Banged Up, episode 10. Here we are. We are churning through them. Hi, guys. All well?
Hi, Rob. How are you?
All good, Rob. All good.
I'm well here. My TV chef career hasn't quite kicked off as I was hoping, but, you know, it's early days, yeah.
It's early days.
If, you know, you can find my Instagram out there. Anyone listening, please get in touch. Other than that, no, we are, I'm just very much looking forward to this episode. We had, yeah, another kind of, we're kind of a return to criminals, if you can say that this time round. And I think in the most kind of traditional sense, our guest this week, Michael, is, I think, what you might, when you say to most people, East End gangster, this is it. You're going to hear him talk about the Craze, the Richardsons, all of that kind of stuff. But I think it's very interesting to hear it come from, yeah, I mean, I think he was just an interesting character. What did you think, Boats?
Yeah, he was, to be fair. He was. I enjoyed it. I didn't talk much again, but yeah, I enjoyed it.
Well, we'll come to that.
Rob, tell us the news of the Instagram poll.
Well, that is good time to bring that up. Boats, the good news for you, mate, is that we hit that magic number. We had lots and lots of interest from our listeners who clearly want to hear less from me. We knew that anyway. And they want to hear more from you, Boats. So anyone listening, if you keep an eye on our Instagram, you will see another very polished and professional bit to camera from Boats in the coming days. But for now, I think, yeah, we've got Michael Emmett, who, yeah, was a career criminal running through the 60s, 70s and 80s. I think I'm right in saying that. And he told us, fairly comprehensively his story. I mean, you're going to hear some amazing bits in there, stuff that, yeah, you honestly couldn't write.
Except he has. He's written it in a book.
Yes, he has as
good,
well.
Good point, well made. He has written it. You could write it, and he has. Paddy will edit that bit in. Just a fascinating insight into, you know, a kind of story that's been told a number of times, these kind of things. You know, you've seen Legend with, Tom Hardy told the kind of Craze story. So we've had, you know, recent years, we've had kind of little bits of insight into this, but to get a full horse's mouth account of this stuff was, yeah, unbelievable.
Well, let's get to it then.
My story's about trauma. The obvious is crime, but my story's about trauma and my whole life. That's why I have a faith. And I'm not religious at all, but my struggles have started at a very, very young age, and it formulates like a sort of a third person. You've got your good, bad, your bad, your good side and your bad side, and then you've got this auto thing that's trying to sort of play with you. And I do believe it's a genetic thing, but also I was abused as a child. And it wasn't intense, but I was very young. It wasn't very nice. I went into denial about it. And so I started very, a very, very young age. I used to have real big tantrums and I'd scream and I'd shout. And, you know, my parents thought there was something wrong with me, well, there was. But I had a very unusual father and a very unusual mother, actually. So I was made up of both of their sort of their DNA, but I believe it's spiritual as well. I mean, my grandfather committed suicide. He was a lunatic. He's a very violent man, bless his heart. But, you know, he didn't know what he was up to. He wasn't very well mentally, had mental health issues without a doubt. I mean, he killed himself with acetone and they found his stomach coming out of his mouth. So it was a very traumatic sort of lifestyle my dad had. My mum's life was completely different. And I was boxed into that, and so my stuff started very, very early. I started stealing very early. I didn't have the mindset of a young kid. You know, I just wanted to be out there, and I was this mixture of opposite. I was very fearful, but very fearless, and it started at a very young age, and then it just manifested itself into all sorts of things.
Well, I think you mentioned that, and I think you talk about it in the book as you touched on it there. I think it's a really interesting point that I don't think, unless you want to, we don't have to dwell on it. But I think you talked about how you were abused by a babysitter, was
yeah.
it, when you were
I'm
you were
okay
very
to
young.
Speak about it.
Yeah, well, I think that's a really interesting point, because I think obviously it's something that is still a bit taboo and lots of people find really difficult to talk about. But I think it'd be really interesting. Claire, you've probably got a bit more experience of this from kind of chatting to people inside. But I think it's probably something that frames a lot of people's kind of outsets. And when it happens from such a young age, it kind of almost kind of sets the tone from then on. But absolutely. But maybe you could tell us a bit about how you kind of felt that affected you from that young age and kind of how that kind of spiraled from there.
Well, I'll tell you what it was. I mean, you know, some people have said, how do you remember? Trust me, you remember. And how it started, I went into therapy about it, and they sort of give me a bead on what they thought. And so it really affected my life, because I repeated the abuse, not in that way, but I'm not in that way. So, you know, I was traumatized. I was screaming, I was shouting. And what the therapist said, and I don't want to get into therapy, but what he said to me, that when you was in that room and my parents were next door, it would have broke their heart if they'd have known. My inner voice was screaming for my mother. So I felt abandoned. Yeah. So I wasn't aware of that. But I picked up that abandonment issue. I was very angry. But as I got older, I don't mean to be rude when I talk about women, young lady. I don't mean to be rude or crude. But I never settled with a woman. And I always had two women in my life. Not that I was anything special, but I always had two women in my life. And one represented the abuser and one represented my mother, because my mother's love was unconditional. It was incredible. I had an incredible mother, and all she used to do was love. So it did affect my relationship, and I started looking at girls at a very, don't mean to be crude, darling, but at a very, very young age. You know, when a 5-year-old boy gets exposed to sex, you know, when he's 11 and things start happening downstairs, don't mean to be rude. So you start to think it's allowed. You don't think it's wrong. You know, you teach a kid French when he's 6. When he's fluent in it by 10. So I was taught something that was very dysfunctional, and it affected my life, you know, big style, big time.
So obviously you say it kind of affected relationships, but do you think that kind of spilled over into how it kind of manifested in what other aspects of your life? So we're going to come on to now, kind of as you progressed, as you got older, you mentioned that you were almost kind of born into a bit of a kind of crime was a bit of a family business, which I'd like massive. To touch on. But do you think that then kind of set the tone for how you kind of behaved as you grew up?
Well, I suppose it's a good question, because it did. I was very, you know, I was a mixture of an opposite. I said I was very fearless and very fearful. And so I'm very addictive, very addictive. So crime's another addiction. But for me, my old man was my father. He had the same sort of stuff as me. He was very broken, but you learn to hide it with masks. You know, you never know what's going on. That's why I don't judge anybody. You don't know what's going on with people. So my old man was, he was notorious, my father. He was a very shrewd criminal. You know, he didn't want all the publicity. He didn't want notoriety. He was a cunning old fox, the old boy, but he knew everybody. So, you know, the Cray twins, the Richardsons, the train robbers were my dad's friends, all the great train robbers. And so we ventured into a life of crime, albeit he was very intelligent. And they had high hopes from him as a young kid. He was at the technical college. He ran at White City. He was an athlete. He sang in a choir, bless him. But his life was very, very damaged as well with his own father. And so, you know, crime became, he was a war baby. And they used to like nicking money and food and things like that. But he progressed. He had a reputation, put it like that. You wouldn't want to have a fight with him. And so I was one of his sons. And he had 7 kids altogether, 4 marriages, bless him. But I was his son who, I suppose, in retrospect, was sort of very much like him. Very much like him.
What age did you become aware? So, I mean, you know, I guess most people have heard of definitely of the Crays and the Richardsons, who were probably one of the biggest crime families in that kind of, what, 60s, 70s?
Yeah, that sort of time.
Are we talking then? So they're like, you know, we're talking real, like, you know, the biggest kind of crime names around at that time. How old do you remember being aware of, like, being knowing that your dad was involved in that and that was kind of the family business?
Excuse me. It's funny, you know, because as kids, you know, youth is wasted on the young. because I think we're very askew, and I think we know things. And I don't know how it is, but for me, I was aware at a very young age. I don't want to dig my dad out here, but you know, I see violence. It wasn't meant; it happened, and I saw him have a terrible argument with a guy one day, and the fella fell against the car. He a kid. My dad broke his heart. He didn't mean it. And then I saw him do something else. And then before I knew it, I started feeding myself at 11. He went mad, the old man. He didn't show me how to do it because he took me out of South London to live in Surrey. So he wanted me to go to a good school. But I was going down to Woolworths, nicking things at a very young age. And it was, I don't know, there was a subconscious thing about it. You know, there was a thrill, there was an excitement. And then one day I walked into our garage and he was making number plates. And I knew straight away what he was doing. But he pretended he wasn't. So that went in. And then I got in trouble as a very young kid for fighting. And he knew this sort of copper. He definitely wasn't an informer, my dad, but he knew this copper, who was obviously bent. And I went to meet him. It was only a silly charge, but he could have given me a criminal record at the age of 14, 15. And when I went and met this guy, he was a big policeman, and he got 9 years. He was head of the the pornographic shops in the West End. He was head of the vice squad, and he was double.
I don't. Boats probably does though.
He got 9 years, this guy. So I went to see him, and 10 minutes or an hour later, I was taken to the police station with 11 of my mates from school, all their parents worried, and the same man walked in who I just met in Bentalls in Kingston. Now, I didn't go, oh, hold on a minute, I just met you a minute ago. I just knew to keep my mouth shut. So all this sort of computerised information, from the abuse to the feeding myself, seeing my dad have a violent fight, and then meeting this guy and not saying nothing. And my dad was adamant. When he used to come and get me from the police station, he'd want to hit me because he didn't want me to be a criminal. And then I started to meet all of them. You know, I went to work for my dad in a Goodyear yard in Battersea. So I started to meet Eddie Richardson, Freddie Foreman. I knew him very young. Fred was the henchman, but the twins, they say. He was a lovely man. He wasn't an henchman. He was a lovely man. And then I started to meet the great train robbers. I met most of them. And then I used to go out with their sons, and we'd be in the West End sniffing cocaine, going out with girls and dancing and having some fun. So, and then the fraternity in London then, I don't want to big crime up, but the fraternity in London then was a very tight community of criminals, and everyone knew each other. And, you know, there was street credibility to what crimes you've had and what crimes you haven't done. And so when you're seeing these guys getting 30 years in prison, it becomes second nature. You see it as something that you do, and I didn't even think about it. I just adapted to it like a duck to water.
Was that common? When was the first time you remember seeing one of, like, your dad's mates or someone get a big, big stretch?
Well, excuse me. When I started to understand it a little bit, there was a guy called Brian Mottram and a guy called Bobby Jennings. They was out of Battersea. My dad knew them. And I heard a few little bits and pieces. But the first man who I really... Well, my uncle John Chandler. He's not my uncle, but he was like my uncle. He got a bit of bird out in Thailand. He was out there looking after someone. They was bringing some stuff back. So I remember my dad used to write to him and send him money, and we used to put little things in the card. I was about 15 then. And then I started to realise, it's funny, it's really strange, because we was living a lie as children and we accepted it. But what kept us motivated in the normal life was the love of my mum. So it's a very confused household. But my dad used to keep it really like, my dad used to pretend we was normal. We lived in a street. We run the football team. There was all big coppers, policemen who lived in our street. But my dad used to try and keep it very, very normal because he was bright and he had straight businesses. But underneath it, And then I started to understand about.
So it was kind of like unspoken at home, like around your mum and stuff. It was kind of
not really.
There was a bit of a facade, or was it
in front of the kids? But my mum knew.
Okay.
But my mum loved my dad. I don't think she condoned it, and she didn't like violence. And when she used to know that someone had been murdered, it was in the papers or something like that. We weren't into that. Or he got killed, and all. It weren't like nothing like that. And then I was at the yacht club when I was 18, when a guy died in front of me, bless him. It was a Johnny Bindon, they charged John. I don't know if you know that story about the yacht club, and there was two gangs fighting. Google it. And so I was there picking up my dad, and it doesn't matter what I witnessed, but I was a young kid. I didn't give a monkeys. You know, I was in the mix. There was people, all sorts of things going on. And, the geezer died, God rest his soul. And so I was only 17, 18. So I was in it then, and I started to have a fight myself a little bit. So, at a young age, I suppose, it just develops, Become a plumber. You don't know when you crack it. You do your apprenticeship, and all of a sudden you're a good plumber. So that was it, really.
So you're kind of like 17, 18. You've done your kind of apprenticeship there. What age did you start kind of progress into kind of full time? Did you progress to working with your dad? Did you go off on your own? How did that kind of then move on from there?
I've done a lot of things that I can't really say, but when I was about 18, 19, 20, I started to do little bits and pieces myself. I was handling all stolen antique furniture. I was doing up to all sorts of things. There was always little moves going on. I used to have crooked MOT books. I had all sorts of things. I used to sell a little bit of puff. And, nothing outrageous. But because of my dad's influence, my dad at that particular time was smuggling half a ton of cannabis into the country every 2 months. So what was going on with that?
It didn't feel like too serious compared to that.
No, not at all. But so there was off spills for that for me, And he used to look after me, and I used to do a couple of things for him. And his partner was a guy called Joe Pyle. I don't know if you've ever heard of Joe. He was a notorious sort of villain in London. And so my dad and Joe, Arthur Sutty was my dad's working partner. He was a sort of a renowned sort of criminal. But it was fun as well.
Michael, how much can you tell us about how you bring half a ton of cannabis into the country?
It's very difficult for me to tell you how you do it, but I mean, I can touch on it because I don't want to get anyone in trouble. But my dad used to bring it over in lorries, and he used to unload it. We had potato pitches all around Kent, and it used to be unloaded there. But you're talking about the 70s, 80s, when no one had a clue, and it used to get delivered. People used to come and pick it up and deliver it. And then there was an alleged shooting, which stopped the enterprise. And then my mother and father went out to Italy to pay some money. And they never kidnapped them forcefully, but because the money was short, they took my mum and dad hostage. I was only 19, so that sort of played about with me. And, they were Italians, proper Italian people. And my dad knew that, him and Joe went out to America, and they was involved with one of the big crime families out there, mafia. And so you hear stuff and you see stuff and then you start to realise. I can tell you about what I got arrested for about smuggling, because I was arrested for that, but that wasn't at that particular time. And then I tell you why when I was a kid, I got arrested. Excuse me. I was in a police chase with a mate of mine. He's dead now, and there was some cocaine in the car, and we got chased by about six police cars, an helicopter. We were doing about 80 miles an hour. We went through a garden fence. A fella was underneath his boat, sanding it down. We nearly knocked him over. It's crazy stuff. And there was some cocaine. It was in the steering wheel, and it wasn't mine actually. But there was one ounce on the side, which I managed to get rid of out the window. I was only having a lift. And, I was involved, but it wasn't to this. It wasn't my bit of work. Yeah. And, I used to get all things off my dad to sell. And so we got caught bad. My mate went through the window screen, the car, Constantine, and they never found the drugs in the steering wheel. First, they only found the 1 ounce. I was in a wheelchair. I got bail. My dad got me some Judge and Chambers. I got bail. And I went out to Marbella. Yes, I was wanted by the police in London.
So when was this? What year is
1983, this? 1984. So I was naughty.
Okay, so Marbella. So
sorry?
So you absconded.
Absconded, yeah. We say you went on your toes. It means you run away. So I went out there and I started messing about. And there was I don't want to go into too deep. I used to do a few little bits and pieces and take bits and pieces down to, I know you want to hear more, but I have to be careful. I couldn't tell you about what I was arrested for. So I used to smuggle bits and pieces in Europe, getting a few quid. I was only a young kid. I was very game.
Would it be fair to say you weren't the only person on your toes down in Marbella in 1983? There was probably quite a few lads from London down there at that time.
If you was there before 1983 or 84, there was no extradition. So you had the famous five down there, Freddie Foreman, Ronnie Everett, Ronnie Knight, Johnny Mason, all lovely fellas. They were wanted for sort of, I don't know what they was wanted for, the Brinks mate or something. But then it was all the other scallywags. They all knew my dad, old Jackie Kramer. God rest his soul, he died. So I had an open arm committee there. But I had a fight down there. I shouldn't have really had a fight with a big champion boxer called Eddie Aoff. And I think all the villains said, look, Mike, you can't do that because they're sling us out if we commit crimes here. So I was a bit of an AF. I was young and wild. And he broke my nose, the geezer. And he'd knocked a few of my friends out who were straight, lovely boys. Martin Emmett, my brother, little Adam Bolton, lovely boy. And they got a bit of a clump. And I set about this guy and all the gangsters were there. So all of a sudden, it was being a bit uneasy for me there. So I slipped off and I'd done a bit of work myself and got a few quid down in France and then came back. But something very tragic happened. And my grandfather was dying in the UK. And my brother come down to stay with me. He was a beautiful boy, my brother. Lovely boy. He wasn't a criminal. Charles's father. And we were chalk and cheese. He was very well educated, very well spoken. Lovely boy. Yeah, lovely young man. And funnily enough, his girlfriend, Charles's mother, she was 3 months pregnant with Charles. It was a tragic story. And my brother was with me. We was using cocaine. My dad was having an affair, bless his heart. We had an argument and my brother went off and he went underneath a lorry and he got killed, stone dead. So it was a madness really started from the abused child to the crime to, you know, and all of a sudden you become numb. You're not living in a conscious state of mind. You're living in a subconscious state of mind. And all you do is want to fix it with drugs or money. And so you lose yourself. And I came back because my brother died and my grandfather died. We buried them together. That was horrendous. Got arrested for the thing that I left England for. And instead of getting 7 years, I got 3 or 4 not guilties. There's a story what goes with that one. I can't do that. But there's stuff I can tell you later on. And I wound up getting 18 months. Which is a wow. Real blessing for me. And I got 5 not guilties in the court. Because really, I had a good chance. My mate got 9 years. He sort of was saying it weren't me. You know, all that sort of stuff goes on. And then I was, you know, my induction to crime was then underway. Definitely underway. And it was the second time I'd been in prison. I'd done remand in 1980 in Brixton. Everyone knew my dad. Kenny Noy was there. Brian Reed, the guy who'd done the... thing at Hatton Garden, little Brian Reed, a lovely man. And so they all knew my dad, you get looked after. I went down to Falls.
So was that a good thing? That was the link to your dad, you think, was helpful rather than unhelpful?
Well, it was very helpful. Right. You know, he opened doors in prisons for me, in crime. I was a wild card. And I don't mean he can handle me, but I was a mad young kid who was addicted to excitement.
So you went in for the second. So you did Brixton the first time. Second time you do 18 months. Where do you do that?
Well, I went to Wandsworth, and then I went down to East Church. Got in some trouble there. Had a bit of a couple of arguments in that, Nick. And then I managed to get down to Ford against all odds, but my wife was pregnant with one of my children. And they terminated
the prison. Was Ford an open prison at the time?
Yeah, it was great. It was like being in like army barracks. We had some fun there. And I was young and wild. I got down there, knew loads of people there. Excuse me, all smoking cannabis and having fun and having parties and just, you know, not that criminal, I don't want to put emphasis on getting prisoners in trouble or anything like that, but we know what goes on. And then I came out.
I don't think it's
there.
Changed too much to this day.
Sorry?
Yeah. I don't think it, I had a couple of mates down there. I don't think it's changed much.
Okay, there you go. There you go. So it was fun, you know, it was fun. And I came home and I was scarred by my brother. I had two children by this time. And it was really funny because there was a vicar there called Mr. Vickers. And I went and done a Bible course there. I didn't do it because I wanted to go into the church. I'd done it to get out, and we used to go out Sundays and have fish and chips. And I used to say to the prison officer, I used to say to the vicar, pull up here, in Littlehampton it was, and we'll have some rock and cod and chips and all that. And he said, I've got no money. I said, I have. So I'd buy about five or six of us. We'd meant to be going to church. So they're all little perks like that. I mean, a lot more serious things, but they were the funny ones. And then I was meant to get confirmed. This is a funny story. I went to the appeal courts on the 18-month sentence and got out. I had about 2 weeks to go. They let me go 2 weeks early, but I was getting confirmed in the nick. And my first wife, Tracy, her father was ex-army, and so was Mr. Vickers. And he phoned me up, or my father-in-law, because I was getting confirmed. So I went back to the prison 2 days after I'd been out. The prison officers at the gate thought I was late coming back. They didn't realise I'd been released. And I went in, I see all my mates, I got confirmed. You know, I got up to a few little tricks, what don't matter what I'd done. And I came out, and that was the start of it. And I wanted a change. I just didn't have the ability. I loved the madness. I loved it.
So how old are you at this point, Michael?
I was about 20, from Marbella to then, I suppose, from 24 to about 27. So I smuggled in Europe, went to prison, come home, got confirmed, come home, and thought I was going to be
a big... you knew then, even before your long stretch, that you wanted to change. You just didn't quite know how at that point.
Maybe. I mean, everyone who goes into prison either says they're going to change or they can't wait to get at it. But there was a part of me, the mother in me, that I wanted to sort of be with my kids and all that. But I was unstable. I was unstable. I had affairs with people I shouldn't have had affairs with. I wasn't very, very, you know, funny enough, I had good morals. But this sort of addict behaviour that I had, and it's no excuse, but I started to repeat what happened to me. I was having affairs everywhere. I was a broken man after my brother died. And that ain't no excuse. You know, I have to take responsibility for my behaviour. But that's how it was. And then I came home, and before I knew it, I was messing about again, taking drugs. The police come to my house one day looking for I was gone. I was in so much anguish. I was smoking freebase. They call it crack. And I was in my house. And the police come looking for a lot more than they found. And all I had was a dirty bag of cocaine that I'd been smoking for 2 days. It was all bits of everything. Tea bags in there where I was smoking, washing it all up. There was things on the carpet. It did look like a nice bit of cocaine. It looked diabolical. And I'd been smoking it for about a day and a half mad. And the police kicked me door in. And as they come running up the stairs, I had a bit of a fight with them. And I grabbed a bag of cocaine. And they weren't looking for half ounces. There was about 10 grams there. There wasn't an ounce of it, but they was looking for a few kilo. But anyway, they got that, whatever. And so I threw it at them. It all come out the bag. It all went on the floor. I've got these coppers bashing me. And my wife just come back from Hong Kong. And it was when they started the war with Saddam Hussein. It was that day. But I was broken, and I think they knew it. I was gone. The death of my brother, smoking drugs. So I wasn't capable of committing crimes then. I was just getting drugs to keep my habit going for a couple of years. But I was still involved, you know, I was still messing about, but not for a financial gain. I just wanted to fix this hole that created inside of me. And I got nicked again, actually.
So when did it change and you became, you know, the international drug smuggler?
Okay, so my dad was already one. And he was getting...
That helps.
Yeah, that helps. Yeah, absolutely.
Got foot in the door. It's who you know.
I had the key to the door. So after I come out of prison and then I got arrested again, and then we got involved with something I can't talk about, and we got a lot of money out of it. And then instead of me being wise, I was just so broken. I went out and I spent it all. It was a lot of money in the 80s. So my dad got arrested with Joe Parle for a ton of puff. And they got acquitted. So when my dad came home, that had been smashed to pieces. The Joe Parle and Brian Emmett gang, that had gone, well, they're not gangs, but that had gone on for a good 12 years. And the police said, behave yourself. We've had enough of you. You got away with it too much. There was all sorts of things that went on. Nothing bad, but the evidence weren't right. It was all sorts of things like that. And they got out of that. And my dad came to me. And I was just sort of getting myself on my feet again. He said, do you want to go to work? And I was now about, how old was I then? In 1989. So I was 31. And I went down to Marbella. Had a lot of bad memories there because of my brother. And I went down there with a few quid. And he introduced me to the people in Morocco. I can't speak about that. But what I can speak about was I got introduced to a man who came to me and asked me, could I get some drugs into the UK, cannabis? So I knew someone who knew someone. And I can't elaborate on this bit, but I can elaborate on the next bit. And allegedly, there was 10 ton of aborted near Swansea. Allegedly, there was a boat pugged up by Lundy Island, and it never took place, and the stuff went in the sea. Now, that wasn't mine, but I'd done a few favours, and I knew a few people. And I got arrested for that, but I never got charged for it. Otherwise, I'd tell you more about it. But what happened after that, I was in Spain, up to no good. I mean, the people came to me again and asked me, did I want to put 5 ton, buy some drugs, buy some cannabis? And you just don't happen. There's history with this, but I can't, at the moment, I can't say it. So so the connection that went back to my father from the Americans, from the Dutch, from the Moroccans, you know, we were well set. We were well introduced. There was lots of corruption. There was lots of transport vehicles, boats. It was big time, and it came. I knew it was coming close to be arrested in Spain. There was police everywhere. I'd spot them, but you know you're in it to win it, and so I agreed to this 5 ton. We done what we had to do, but this is the miracle. They wanted to put some cocaine on this boat, and I said yes to it. 250 kilo of coke. And I was going to have half of it, and I was going to sell the other half to them. So I worked out the size of it. They wanted to hide it in the 5 ton. So it was, you know, I was in it to win it. It was all about money. But something told me, circumstances happened. Now, I left that beach in Fuengirola and said, I'll do it. Put the 250 kilo of coke on. And I went up the hill and I bumped into I'd now left the mother of my children, and I was married to her. Well, I wasn't married to her at the time. I met an Italian girl whose father had restaurants in Marbella. And I was going one way, she was going the other way. And I caught her eye and she never stopped. She was crying her eyes out. And it made me stop the car. And I turned back around and the soft voice inside of me, I went back down to that beach and I said, leave the 250 kilo of cocaine out of it. I'd have got 35 years. No, Michael. You know, there was Italians, there was Bosnians, there were Moroccans. It was a big thing that we was doing. It was massive. And I can't, you know, it was far bigger than 5 ton. You know, that wasn't my part. My part was this 5 ton. So we organised it. we went with a fisherman down in a place called Biddeford in Devon. Lovely guy he was. And my mate, my partner, Peter, he got his team together, and I arranged all the stuff, and they brought it down into Biddeford in Westwood. There was a lot of organisation that went on with it. I never put the cocaine on, thank God for that. And so it arrived in Biddeford, in Westwood O, at about 10 o'clock on November the 7th. And it should have come in on the morning tide. It should have come in on the night tide, but it came on the morning tide. So it sat in Biddeford on the floor, because it was tidal, for about 11 hours on the boat. And we thought we'd done it, you know. And we let the tide come back in so the boat could come up. I weren't there. And we sent, there was about 9 guys there, fishermen, fishmonger, the drivers. And as they was unloading it, I think there was 60 officers there. I think about 60.
Around then.
No, because I think there was a Frenchman there, a man called Lemonnier. I wouldn't tell you his name if it weren't documented. And, you know, I'm not here to tell tales, but it's a story. It's a true story. And this broker boy who I was, they nicked all them. I think it's either 12 or 16, I'm not sure, armed officers, and all over Biddeford Quay with guns and night sights and all things like that. And I wasn't there at the particular time, but they wanted me. For some unknown reason, they thought I was the protege of Brian Emmett, and I weren't really. And he had a reputation, my dad, and they knew he was a cunning old criminal because he'd hardly done any prison sentence. And there's a few of them out there who haven't. And they, you know, they're cunning. And one thing we never told was tell tales. It was our business. It was money, you know. So I didn't go to the scene of the crime. Foolishly, my dad told me not to, with a driver friend of mine and my co-defendant. And as we come over the bridge at Biddeford, it's for single cars. And as we've come over the side, because we're trying to phone up the guy who's got the lorry, the phone's gone dead. I said, hold on, Peter, this is honest here. But we was had to go and see it. We weren't sure. And when we got there, as we come over the bridge, bomb, these action lights went on, night sights, you know, rifles, and they started shouting my name out. Michael Emmett, get out of the car. God, I didn't want to, you know what I mean? I wanted to go back in time 10 minutes. But bizarrely, I was telling this story the other day, about 3 months before this, and it's quite important that I just run back to this. Mm. I was in a place in Morocco with some real heavy sort of villains. There was a gun there. We was having a chat about all what was going on. And you're not really meant to. Anyway, I wanted a puff. Shouldn't have had a puff. It was a very important meeting. It was disrespectful. and I was stoned. And underneath the curtain came this very small mouse, right? And I jumped up and went, oh, my God, I'm meant to be this villain's son doing the big drug deal. And I'm petrified of a mouse.
The image you want to give off, is it?
But then 3 months later, I'm asked to be getting out of a car with rifles and handguns pointed at me, and I didn't give a shit. Sorry, this one. I wasn't frightened. It was bizarre. I'm not frightened of guns, but I was okay. And I sort of, they say I've got quite a powerful voice. And when I say that it was noisy, Peter was on the floor being hit with a gun. The driver, God rest his soul, he collapsed. He put it in first gear. I tried to get away. We weren't going anywhere. He fell out the car. And when I jumped out the car, it's a pretty cool scene. You got men on the quayside with their rifles. And it becomes surreal. And all of a sudden, I had someone's phone number in my pocket. Not that they would have got in trouble, but I just didn't want them to have it. So I went to take the number out of my pocket, and they shout out, he's got a concealed weapon. Now, you don't want them thinking you've got a concealed weapon, yeah. Especially when it's a bit of paper. So I tried to. Anyway, I then shouted, shut up, everyone shut up, leave him alone. And just for a nanosecond, it became apparent that my voice had stopped everything And it was like the film stopped. It came back very quickly. But I remember it profoundly. And I knew that they were frightened of me. And I don't know why, but they were nervous of me. So I took advantage of that. You smell it, don't you? Eventually, they smashed me to the floor, handcuffed me, put a gun to my head, and said to me, "A penny for your faults." And I had tears in my eyes, honestly. I wasn't frightened of them. And I said, "My three children." He said, "Do what?" I said, "Go on. Piss off and leave me alone." And I just, my old life sort of ended there. It was a relief. I'd have been involved in international crime at a very high level for a number of years. Thank God the cocaine weren't there. And we got nicked. And because of the notoriety of my father, they wanted my dad badly. It all came to an end in November 1993.
Did you feel like the game was up then? When you got nicked, that guy's going penny for your thoughts, was your immediate thought, "I'm done here"? Or did you think, was there still a bit of fight and you thought, you know, we'll see how this plays out?
Well, them emotions changed, yeah. 5 minutes previous to me getting nicked, I would have done anything to get away. But the adrenaline had kicked in. And when I was sitting on the floor, I'll never forget, I was looking up at the sky and it was one of them blistery nights. And the clouds were... So you could see the moon, then the cloud would pass. You couldn't, it was dark. It was like, it was all sort of lights on me. And then all of a sudden, reality set in. And I'll be honest with you, at that particular time, I was relieved. Because this, I haven't told you everything, but this was really intense for 18 months. Meetings in different places in the world, money, big money bags, and, you know, all that sort of stuff. It was organised crime at a high level.
So the game is kind of up and we fast forward. So what sentence did you land off that in the end? I mean, thankfully, so it sounds like you said if you'd had the cocaine, you'd have got 35 years.
30 years.
What did you get in the end then for the cannabis?
Well, so I was arrested for the importation of the aborted importation. I was arrested for a conspiracy and I was arrested for the 5-ton. And they wanted, I think they wanted £3 million off of me, my dad, Lemonnier and Peter, or I think do 6 years, yeah? So they wanted 800 grand each or 7.5 hundred, £3 million they wanted. And the maximum sentence was 14 years. There was a grant, there was an informer involved, not that we knew, but they changed the law over it because if you could name the informer, you'd walk out. And then they changed the law with a white report, I think over this case, because it was a massive case for them. I mean, you can Google it and find out. It's all on there. And so they never found us with any money. They found my dad with £1 grand. They found me with 30 grand. I think they thought they was going to find millions. So we had the fine. And then they said it was a guilty plea. We got out of the first importation. We got out of conspiracy. We held our hands up to stop a 9-month trial. And we got 12 and a half years. Plus the fine, but we got out of that. The fine, we got it reduced to, they wanted a guilty plea, so they reduced the fine to 400 grand. They said, that's how much we give for it in Pakistan, or wherever it came from. It was from Pakistan, here you go. And so that's what they said. And we got 12 and a half years and 400 grand fine. So it was cool. I was happy with that.
Yeah, I mean, those sentences have probably increased a fair bit now.
Well, maximum for cannabis is only 14 years, no matter how much you got of it. It was funny in the court case, there was Judge Neville, he was a right tough guy, this guy, and bless his heart, they say that his daughter was a heroin addict, which I sympathise with, but they wanted my dad badly, and he made out he was an old man in the court, and they wanted my dad badly. And Judge Neville was saying that cannabis, which is a Class B drug, has a maximum sentence of 14 years. He said it should be more. It should be more. This drug's a killer. And whatever view you got on cannabis is up to you. And one of the barristers, he was trying to make it bad for us. And one of the barristers jumped up in the court and he said, "Your Honour, He said, the only way this drug could kill anybody, he said, if it fell on top of them, right? The amount it was, 5 tons. So there was all that going on, and there was, but anyway, we held our hands up, and right towards the end, they changed the indictment, and the summing up against my dad was pretty naughty. They changed the indictment to his name right before sentencing. He said, I've been waiting for you. We've been waiting for you for a long time. In other words, you've got away with it for far too long. Your hands stretch around Europe and America. And you will be, he's only a little old boy. He was a blind, he was. And, you know, he wanted my dad, and they smashed my dad completely. And really, for what he'd got away with, to be honest with you, 12 and a half years was a sort of an arbitrary get out for him, really. But my mother was devastated because my brother had just died. Mm. Me and my dad had died. I got 12 and a half years. My dad got 12 and a half years. So it was a messy sort of time for us.
Must have been really difficult, yeah. So that's even then, so that's 12 and a half to six and 3 months or something, is it? That you did?
Well, God's grace was good. I went to the appeal courts, didn't expect to get anything off. And I went to the appeal court, and on a point of law, we got 3 years off. So I think I'd done about 3.5 years, and I got I went to the appeal courts, got 3.5 years, got that time off. The fine got paid, so I came home just. I mean, I was over the moon. I just under 5 years. I'd done.
Mm.
And where did you do that? Where did you serve those your five, like the bulk?
Well, I should have been on the Cat A book in Bristol, but. God's grace again. I started off in Exeter. They wanted to move me to put me in on the Cat A down in Bristol with my dad and Peter and the Lemonnier. But there was 14 of us, so we stayed in the B-Cat local for about 18 months. I loved it there. And then we went from there, and then we went up the Swale side. Then we went to Maidstone. That's where I was with Reg. Then we went to Reggie Cray. And then I went to a place called Blantyre House in Kent. And then I finished off in Latchmere in Richmond.
Are we right in saying that you shared a cell with your dad? That's got to be...
For 2 years.
Did he you?
Drove me nuts.
Who was drove that? Each other more nuts? Do you think...
Well, do you know what it was? He was... he fancied himself as an artist and all things like that, my dad. And so we was in a cell together. And I... used to puff all the time, and I had always had that skunk in there. And one day he come into the cell, and there was an old smuggler along the landing, and because they was sort of elderly, they had the two best jobs in the nick. My old man was he used to work on a reception because it was a remand jail, and the other geezer used to work in the officer's mess. But he liked to puff this other geezer, and I knew he used to wear this wig. He was a funny character. And anyway, my dad was hanging out with him. So the old man's come in the cell, and I don't know if you've had a puff, no doubt you have. So he starts, he keeps poking his tongue out, and all his lips have gone dry. And he said, we got anything to eat in here? I looked at him, I said, what you been up to? He said, I've had a puff. Now, he was one of the biggest puff smugglers in the UK with Joe Parr in the 70s and 80s. They were big other people, but he was big in it. And he'd never smoked it. It was a commodity to him. He'd ate it once and it'd come open in him and he freaked him out. He's now stoned and I'm getting stoned.
Horrible.
So we started getting stoned every night together in the cell. It's crazy. Singing Irish rebel songs. And then he used to get the munchies and all that. And then I had an experience in there. I started sniffing cocaine in there. And because I was a heavy user, you know, so that sort of he didn't realize. And I was sniffing coke, taking some marzipans, getting him stoned. And then one day it was mandatory drug testing. And the prison officer came in and said to me, listen, they're on you for smoking. Be careful, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, I can never give this up. But something happened to me. I had an argument with my wife. Well, my two wives, I know it's crazy. I wasn't married to them both at the same time, but I was now married to an Italian girl. We had an Italian restaurant in Spain called the Regina. All the villains used to go in there. And my wife with my children, and I was arguing with both of them. They befriended each other, so it all got a bit complicated. And I smoked too much cannabis in the cell, and I had the naughty panic attack. It really frightened me, it did. And when I woke up in the morning, I still had this panic attack. So I started taking Tamiflu pills to get me out of that. You know, I was in the gym, I was everything, and I wobbled. And I weren't frightened of anyone on the wing or frightened of anybody, but I had an experience. I think all the trauma of the children stuff, that my brother, the prison, the drugs, the money, you know, millions of pounds involved. I just had a turn for the worse, but it done me a right favour, to be honest with you. Done me a right favour.
Would you change any of it, Michael, going back?
I don't think. I mean, there are certain things. I had an affair with my best friend's wife. Terrible. It cost me a dear friendship, and it cost me a business that was worth a huge amount of money. But I was gone, and I was fixing myself on everything that was bad. But that affair was. I repeated what I had done to me as a child. It was someone. It's no excuse. I take responsibility for my own behaviour. But I repeated an abusive. I wasn't abusive to her, but this whole situation was abusive. And where I was, I think I was a nice guy. Everyone was sort of like, I was like, Marmite, you either love me or hate me. And I used to get away with things because I had money. I was popular. But then it all ended. And that's when really I sort of really found Michael. And my faith came into action. And, you know, I'm 21 years sober. Ended a drink for 21 years.
Fantastic. And all that. Congratulations.
Well done.
And all that stuff. I'm no angel. You know, if you hit me on the chin, the Bible says turn the other cheek. I think I'd struggle to do that, even at my age. But I'm a lot more calmer. I've got incredible grandchildren. I'm a lot better today. And we're sort of getting back on our feet.
Are you happy?
It's been
now?
A crazy. Sorry?
Are you happy now?
Yeah, I'm happy. I've got, you know, I've got seven. When I was younger, I adored my girls. I had an affair with another girl, and I've got a child with her, young Ruby. I haven't seen her for a while. But that was part of all this stuff. And so what happened was, I was broken. I'd lost everything. I had nowhere to live. I was officially homeless, and God was with me, and I had to move, and people were looking for me. I was in trouble, and I went down to live on a farm down in Sussex. It was a pig farm. We talk about the prodigal son. My dad came with me. He got dementia. Very sad. You know, rats running everywhere. We're mucking out the pigs. He had dementia. And he used to sing to me, "If they could see us now, that little gang of ours." You know, it's a song. It's about eating fancy dishes and drinking champagne. And we're covered in dogs. And we're covered in pig shit. And so it was an ironic sort of situation. But it humbled me. Mm. I got better there. I had no money. I was living in a £2 million house that the banks were trying to seize. And I got my nutty dad. He was off his head. I had a young kid come to live with us in recovery. I had two dogs. I had no money. And I was living off my dad's pension for about, and then I started working on the farm. And no one could believe it. But I knew, like, I had to go to church on the landings. I knew I had to see this out. I knew I had to ride it through. People were threatening to do all sorts of things. And they was in order. You can't be wrong and strong. But I honestly believe it was a plan to get me where I am today. And to get rid of the masks, and to get rid of the lie, and to get rid of the cheeky chappy. You know, my car was a Range Rover, I had a brand new Range Rover. For the last 18, 17 years, every 2 years I used to change it. I had a big house in Chelsea, I had a lovely apartment in Chelsea. I had all sorts of things. In the end, I couldn't even afford an Oyster card. So it was a real big change. And I didn't want to go back to crime. I wanted to write it out. That's why I wrote the book.
Well, there we go.
Well there we go. Well, sorry, there. Yeah,
I was going to say, Michael, you've lived about 15 different lives, it sounds like. You've been able to tell us about eight of them today. But thankfully, as you said, yeah, you've put it all down on paper. So Sins of Fathers, Michael Emmett, go out, buy it now. Hear some of the bits you probably haven't been able to hear about in the pod today. Michael, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for sharing some of your stories.
Bless you. Lots of love. Bye-bye.
That was Michael. What did you think?
To be fair, I didn't expect the story to be like how he told it. It was a lot to take in. And at first I thought this brother's just talking loads of stuff, but it is kind of believable what he was saying. I don't know what you thought,
it's
Rob.
Quite a lot. I think there's still, he could have carried on. There's a lot of stuff we still don't know.
Yeah.
My encounter, I don't know about you, Boats, and I'm sure, Claire, actually, I'm sure you have, in a professional capacity, met enough people like this, but there's guys inside, I can think of a few in particular in Rochi, Boats, that kind of were those, similar kind of characters. And there are some guys you met inside that you thought, that's bullshit. And there are some guys that, you know, who just tell it and you're like, I can 100% believe that. I'm thinking, Dad, in Rochester, you know who I mean?
Yeah.
Georgie, a few guys like that who are just, you just seemingly cut out for that life. Not for me, if I'm honest.
Not for me.
Not sure I'd be cut out for that. I'll go down the Algarve, but just for a couple of weeks on holiday. Like, it's not for down the Costa del Sol. Not for a career crime, if I'm honest.
He's just very casual about it, isn't he?
Yeah, he was.
Well, I think that's it. I think that's the interesting bit, is that those guys that do have genuinely lived that life. I mean, that is just their existence. That's their existence.
He doesn't glorify it or make it seem like it was good or anything. It was just his life.
Yeah, really interesting. Obviously, you can go and buy his book if you want to read the full story. If you've got kind of 6 to 8 weeks of holiday to use up, I suspect there's enough stories to fill that in there. So go ahead. Hell of an episode, hell of a character. Thank you, Michael.
You have had another Instagram fail this week, Rob. After doing so well, you made more empty promises to the public.
Well, again, I like to keep them guessing. I like to keep them on their toes. You know, after a real bumper week of Instagram lives, etc.
You know, he was concentrating on me, and you should have been doing your own job.
You've actually probably got a point there, Boats. Yeah, I did. Although, I mean, I am like any true leader. I'm going to blame my schedule. And it was, we are recording on a different day today. It gave me a little bit less time.
Sounds good.
I'll probably come up with a couple more excuses, but the nuts and bolts of it are, the question will be going on Instagram after you hear this episode. So look out, still keep an eye on Instagram. It's going to be going out there. We do want to hear your thoughts on how to, review and what's the word I'm looking for? What was the question?
Change, campaign. What would you want to change the justice system?
The question was, if you get no red tape, if you could make, we're butchering
you this, could change one thing about the criminal justice system, what would it be?
We want to hear what you would change about the justice system. That's exactly it. So that will be going out this week, I promise, on the Instagram.
This is going to be quite linked to our next episode. Quite the episode coming up.
Yeah.
I don't know how you got hold of this person.
This is a real coup. I think that's the only way to describe it. I mean, for a small indie podcast like ourselves to get such a superstar.
You say indie?
We're like a small indie film. You know, we're not like a Hollywood blockbuster.
Indie.
We're not Joe Rogan or something out there. We are, you know, we're good at what we do, but, you know, we haven't really got the budget. So to get such a superstar in their field is actually really quite impressive. So, I'm going to tease it. We're not going to give too much more away. Claire, can you reveal anything? Cause you had a big hand in finding our next guest.
Well, you've got to give the public what they want, and popular demand has called for this. So that's what we had to do.
Good. Okay. Well, I think we'll leave it there.
Hope they can live up to the hype.
Guessing. And you're going to have to tune in next week. I've got a couple of reviews. Do you want to hear them?
Absolutely.
Okay. Must listen. Chew3 has put, I absolutely love this podcast. Such an interesting listen every week. The relationship between the hosts is lovely to hear. That's nice. The amount of laughter on each episode really cheers me up on my commute home on a Monday. Well, that's nice. We're brightening someone's day. That's good. Then we've got Just Brilliant. The only pod I actively get excited for every week, and that is from MBoateng64. That is an actual review, by the way. It's just not from MBoateng64. And then this is a genuine one from Apple. You'll see what I've done here. From Elka the Cat, not sure if that's an actual cat. Following on from my earlier review, I also wanted to give 5 stars to Redemption Roasters. I took advantage of the 25% off and ordered some coffee online. It's the best decaf coffee I've ever tried. Highly recommended. Okay, I'm showing to the guys here. That is a genuine review on Apple. If you want to go and check it out, you can. That's Elka the Cat. But yeah, remember, banged up 25 to get 25% off in-store and online with our sponsors, Redemption Roasters. Good work, team. See you next week for our very special guest.
Take care.
See you.